You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Pranusha. Efa Akine coming up on the show. For City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about a new AA survey on time of use charging and Labour leader Chris Hipkins' State of Auckland speech last week. And I spoke to Sapna Samant, who is a GP, storyteller and activist critical of Indian Prime Minister Modi about his expected visit to New Zealand later this year. Pranusha, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about public service cuts, budget priorities and the changes to NCEA. I spoke with Associate Dean Sione Taufa about crypto investment schemes that are spreading through trusted Pacific community networks. And I spoke with Dr. Mohsen Mohammadzaden about risks of using AI to streamline public sector jobs and services.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire maidane. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawe wari wari iahiana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano. He pakeheri rukiruki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The government is heading into budget week with plans to cut core public service, with RNZ reporting fears from public servants that their jobs are once again on the line. At the same time, questions have been raised over the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade being spared from the cuts, and the government has unveiled major changes to secondary education through its proposed NCEA replacement. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about these topics. The government has announced plans to cut the core public service down to 55,000 roles by mid-2029, with nearly 9,000 jobs expected to go. It's being framed as a savings and efficiency exercise, but unions and Labour have warned it will damage public services. What's Labour's response to the scale of these cuts?
Well, first and foremost, I want to acknowledge the anxiety that this creates for many working families across the country. Quite often people think it just affects people in Wellington, but I think of people that live in my community on the North Shore of Auckland and across Auckland, where this will really impact them as well and the uncertainty that it creates. The government really needs to tell Kiwis the services that they will lose as a result of these decisions. They always say it won't affect frontline, but we've seen in the past it certainly has. And so it's time for them to really front up and be clear with the public around which jobs will be lost, whereabouts they're located, and how that will affect the public service overall.
Finance Minister Nicola Willis says this is about fiscal discipline and redirecting money into priorities like health, education, infrastructure. Where does Labour draw the line between reducing the bureaucracy and cutting into services that people rely on?
Well, this is where the government needs to be clear on this, and Nicola Willis as well. Public services are health services, they are education services, and so where is she making those savings and how much of those cuts will be reallocated into key areas that she talks about? It's very unclear, it creates uncertainty, but the flow-on effect really impacts our economy overall. If the public service jobs are lost, then that impacts local businesses, for example.
And what would Labour want to see protected in this budget?
Well, it's important that we are fiscally prudent at all times, but we know the quality of a public service and the importance to the everyday lives of Kiwis You know, these are the things that that Labor stands for, and we want to ensure that we maintain an incredibly strong public service where everyone is well looked after as a result.
RNZ has reported that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade has been exempted from the budget cuts, with Nicola Willis confirming it won't be made to find savings until after the election. What does Labor make of that decision?
Well, this is another example of the circus that is this government, that Christopher Luxon, Nicola Willis really aren't in charge here. What we're seeing is that Winston Peters gets his way again. And, you know, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. And we don't really understand why one particular ministry is being let off yet again. It's unfair.
Does Labor think that other areas should also be protected in that same way?
Well, Labor believes that we should be investing in a strong public service. If there's a case that for MFAT that shouldn't be touched, then that rationale should also be applied in other key areas. I think of the Tertiary Education Commission, I think of the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Health. Those are core public services that we all rely on. And again, the government needs to be really clear as to which jobs will be lost and as a result, how that will impact the public service overall, and the impacts that Kiwis can expect.
Stuff has reported that Nicola Willis is open to the idea of a new ministry centralising things like HR, IT and other administrative work across the public sector. What does Labor think of that idea?
Well, it's still very unclear what in fact Nicola Willis actually wants other than propping up her budget that won't balance itself next week. It's important that she maintains a public service, the quality of that public service that cares for all New Zealanders. So there's a lack of detail here. Where there's efficiencies, we should consider those, of course, but not at the cost of quality public service.
Is there merit in reducing duplication across these agencies, or does Labor worry that this could create a more centralised and less responsive public service?
Well, again, it's not clear what the intentions of Nicola Willis are here, other than to cut back funds in order to make her budget balance. She's still prioritising landlords, she's still prioritising tobacco companies, and these are the choices that this government is making. It's unfair on the public service that they are the new whipping boy under this government. Last year in the budget, it was women with pay equity. This year, it's students in the public service.
Yep, and just turning to education, the government has unveiled more details on its NCA replacement with the new Year 12 and Year 13 qualifications, compulsory exams at every subject, and a new grading scale. What's Labor's response to these changes?
Well, we've been in the House this week for a number of hours fighting against the Education and Training Act. This is the act, for example, that enables charter schools, that takes away power from the independence of the Teachers' Council and removes Te Tiriti o Waitangi from school boards. So the theme continues in how this minister is moving forward with NCA. It has been incredibly narrow. There is work that has been required under NCA, and we certainly started that under the last Labor government. But the decisions that Minister Stanford is making is that they are back to the future. In essence, it's what sounds good, it's slogans, but it's not actually acting in the overall interests of our tamariki.
Is there a risk that students get caught in the transition between these systems?
Well, this is the importance of why NCA changes, for example, shouldn't be rushed through. We need to ensure that the changes are done right and that our children's education is more than the politics that this government is putting forward. The NCA changes and the curriculum changes are important, but it's important that the minister does continue to, or does listen to the sector, which is our teachers, which is our families, to make sure that they're able to implement the necessary changes in a timely manner so that the quality of education is upheld.
And how do you think this will affect teachers, especially around workload and planning?
Well, it all impacts teachers because they're the ones that are having to implement the top-down approach from this minister. She's provided very clear and direct discussions and she hasn't always listened to their feedback. And so it's important that that adjustment is made and the support, the professional development is put in place for teachers to be able to implement this. If the minister continues to rush the NCA changes, then they're not going to be implemented in a sustainable way. It will impact on quality, and most of all, it will be our young people and their learning that will be impacted as a result.
And with the current timeline, are teachers being given enough time and resources to adapt to such a major overhaul?
Well, the answer is no. And the sector teachers have been very clear that they haven't been given enough time on this. The Year 9 students will be the first affected cohort with these changes. And, you know, we've just got to make sure that we're listening to teachers, that we value teachers, because they are the ones in front of the learners on a daily basis. They're the ones implementing the curriculum. And we need to remove pressure where necessary in order to support them to do their jobs.
What would Labor want to see to make sure the current students and teachers are most supported?
Well, I think it's important for Labor that teachers are listened to, that adequate consultation has been done in the first place. That is not what we've seen under the leadership of Erica Stanford. The sector has consistently been ignored in decisions that affect education of our young people. And it's important that we just take a step back, listen to what teachers are telling the minister, and then moving forward from there.
And finally, when you look across the public service cuts, Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade being protected, possible restructuring of government departments and these major education changes, what does Labor think this says about the government's overall direction?
Well, the overall direction is rushed, it's desperate, and it's heavy-handed. It's led out by politics rather than actually good practice, and that's what we've seen time and time again. We need to make sure that we are investing well in our priority areas in health and education, in our public service, to make sure that Kiwis are looked after. By far, responding to the cost of living for New Zealanders at the moment is the number one priority. We aren't seeing that being prioritised by the government. We're seeing a bunch of other things that don't seem to be necessary at this time. And so it's up to Kiwis to actually put the blame back on this government. They promised to fix the economy. They promised a respite to the cost of living. They haven't delivered on that. And this budget is their absolutely last chance to do that.
That was Shannon Halbert speaking about public service cuts, budget priorities and changes to NCEA.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
A survey of Automobile Association members' views on time of use charging has been presented to Auckland Council's Transport and Infrastructure Delivery Committee. The survey found that members were open to congestion charging if it worked, even if they think it's unfair. Labor leader Chris Hipkins gave a State of Auckland speech last week focused on the need for cross-party collaboration on infrastructure projects. I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about both of these topics.
I think the findings of AA's survey, which said that people are kind of cautious, but it has to work for them. I think that's the mood for, like, most Aucklanders feel that way. So I think they've really nailed the pulse of the community in that survey, the wider community, not just their members. And so whatever scheme that that comes at the end of this process for time of use charging, it's got to work, and it's got to be fair for people. And I think part of that fairness is how are we collecting revenue and what is that being spent on? And I would just urge that we can ring fence that revenue and put it back into the transport network. People will be taking more buses or trains because of the charge. We need to actually make it better for them to do that, and so that they're able to do that as well. So that will mean more investment in PT, would be my sort of suggestion. That was a very interesting survey, and I really welcome those results too.
What are the views on time of use charging from around the council table?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a saga around the table. We've had many workshops and discussions over the last few years, really. And we're still not at a stage, funnily enough, where we have to decide exactly what the scheme will look like. We're sort of down to kind of an options situation at the moment. And I'm part of a bit of a working group of a couple of councillors and staff as well to kind of look through those different options and then put it to the full council and put it to the public for their sort of feedback. But we're not quite there yet. So we're all sort of debating it as sort of an idea rather than will it be on this motorway or will it be a ring around the city or will it be something else like that. We're not really at that stage of design yet.
And I want to ask about when it has been introduced overseas, what has the response and effect been and how do you think that could map onto Tāmaki Makaurau?
Yeah, there's been numerous time-use charging schemes across the world in different cities, and the results have been quite interesting, right? So they generally will go in with a certain degree of scepticism and unpopularity, but once people see it operate and once they have less congestion for their commute, there tends to be a lot more support, you know? And that's kind of the world over. There's been some schemes where people have tried and failed to put it in other places as well. But yeah, we've seen results across the world of lower congestion and more public support, although, you know, we'll see how it goes. I think that'll be an interesting thing for the public.
And I want to turn now to ask about the State of Auckland speech that Labor leader Chris Hipkins gave last week. How do Labor's goals around infrastructure development in the city align with Council's?
Yeah, I saw that. So, Chris Hipkins was really big on the importance of bipartisan collaboration on big infrastructure, right? And, you know, we support that completely, and Mayor Brown's big initiative on this for transport, at least, is a 30-year transport plan where we're telling the public well in advance some of the big investments that are needed for the city and how we're going to get there. So we're kind of working on that in this term over the next sort of months and a few years, I think. So that will be really, that's exciting and that's kind of a good example. But I would just emphasise to central government that bipartisan collaboration is good, but that needs to also include councils. Right, so Auckland Council needs a seat at the table when these discussions are happening, and that's why we signed a city deal with the government recently. We would just urge the government of the day, whatever comes after November, to follow through with that and to keep us in the loop and in strong communication around their plans.
In relation to the future of Auckland, what kind of policy discussions would you like to hear in the lead up to the election?
Well, I mean, what a question that is. We've got a lot of issues in Auckland to solve, right? Personally, I think that we have, a housing crisis is still going on and it's still unaffordable in world terms for housing, even though the prices have kind of dampened a bit over the last sort of few years. So we still need to have that discussion about housing and urban planning. I've been personally quite frustrated with the government's continual climb downs from their initial kind of targeting on planning our city and where the houses are going to go. I think we need to be really straight with Aucklanders on that. And also transport. I mean, we've got a bit of a public transport revolution going on at the moment because fuel prices are skyrocketing, right? So we're having record-breaking numbers in our public transport system. We need to sustain that long into the future and actually even increase that. So I'd like us to talk about things like the cost of public transport fares. I think the government could be looking at that. Coverage of the system as well. These are things that help us with our climate goals and our health goals and all manner of things as well. I could go on, but those are a couple of things there.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on a new AA members survey on time of use or congestion charging and Labor leader Chris Hipkins' State of Auckland speech last week.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts on any of these pieces, 5395.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's frontin' in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling the bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Matthew Crawley, how am I supposed to finish sculpting my lamp with all these unmissable Strange Universe gigs on?
Well, how do you think I feel, Harry? Ruben and I finished carving our beautiful two-man Strange Universe kayak 2 months ago. We haven't even had a moment to take it out and see if it floats.
Strange Universe Winter has your June sorted with 1 million great shows. And 95BFM have tickets for B-card holders to the show of your choosing. Stay tuned to breakfast for your cue to enter. Strange Universe Winter. For full lineup and ticketing info, head to banishedmusic.com. T's and C's apply.
The worms better watch their back.
Sometimes you need a bit of uns.
That snooze button better be disarmed.
I like it. It's making my eyelid twitch. Love it.
And the wrong side of the bed better shuffle over.
And they're just so beautifully, like, menstrual.
Because we've got a little something for your gratitude journal.
Cowbella.
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 It's the 95 BFM Breakfast Show with your hosts, Rosetta and Millie. 7 till 10 every weekday. Thanks to 8:30 Coffee Roasters.
Arcade Radio, Thursday nights, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
Arcade Radio. For all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio, Thursday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki.
Arcade Radio. Only on 95 BFM.
Well, if you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
As the government looks to reduce public sector roles, there has been growing discussion around whether artificial intelligence could help streamline public services, but experts are warning that frustration around slow AI uptake should not override the need for proper safeguards and consideration of the workers most affected. I spoke with Dr. Mohsen Mohammadzadeh, senior lecturer in architecture and planning from the University of Auckland, about the risks of automating public sector work. To start broadly, what concerns you most about the government's new push to use more AI and digital technologies in the public sector?
It's a very good question. The thing is that that's kind of the transition to more like automation, AI based. It seems inevitable, but there is a kind of the things government should consider, especially regarding what we hear in news now. Do they have any plan, you know, to somehow put kind of the transition for people and somehow re-scaling them, re-educate them to find the new positions? Because this kind of the transition, like a digital transition and automation, yes, definitely changing the way we are working and somehow increase the efficiency and productivity in some aspects. But you know, what happened to people is the first question, you know, losing their jobs. And you know, it's not quite clear what they want, what kind of the jobs or kind of things they want to eliminate here. I'm not quite sure, actually. It's really based on the AI or digital, to be honest. We need to have more information. Which jobs, will be, you know, eliminated there, and how, what kind of plans they have for people. It's a main concern.
The government has framed AI as a way to improve efficiency and reduce costs. What might be missing from that framing?
Yes. Technology can kind of increase the efficiency and also improve the efficiency and increase the productivity. But again, you know, money is not the main thing here. We need to have a kind of very good plan and policy, actually, to direct the people that are losing the job and put that kind of a transition in the right direction to make benefits for people. Because when we are speaking about it, efficiency and productivity, we are not speaking about just the market. We are speaking about increasing efficiency and productivity for people. So if people are suffering from this process, it's a kind of, it's a rise of question. So it seems technology at the transition to the kind of the digitalization, it's inevitable because of the increasing the efficiency and improve that. But we need, at the same time, we need to have a plan for people, they are kind of the dealing with this kind of the transition. for example, if around the 9,000 jobs were lost. So we have associated costs with it, and most of the time in the calculation cost-benefit models they have, is overlooked, which is like a psychological cost or emotional cost for people that are losing their jobs, and also level of the stress. So it's something we need to plan for it and think about it ahead before, you know, implementing this kind of the policy. It's my perspective.
So when we're talking about AI being streamlined in these public sector roles, who would most likely be affected when we're talking about job losses and wider impacts?
Still, it's not, you know, it's, AI is like a black box. Still, we don't know, actually. Definitely, the impacts would be huge and profound. You know, there is a kind of, there's no doubt about this. But AI is not just one tool. It's a range of the tools. So most of the jobs in the public sector will be affected with this. That, you know, it's quite clear. Something's quite missing in the announcement with the government. It's not quite clear what kind of the AI they are speaking, you know, what kind of automation they are speaking, which aspects, and still we have a lot of concerns regarding to using this kind of the technologies, especially in the public sector, because of the privacy issues, hackability, and the range of the concerns associated with this ones. So what we hear in news is still is not quite clear. Which aspects? Yes, technology is there, but it's a lot of questions about, you know, how it can be used, but especially in the public sector, because, you know, we are speaking about the interest groups, you know, kind of the data of people and hackability, privacy. So it's a range of the things government should think ahead, solve it first, and then use it. And so it's a kind of, it's a lot of question for the government at this stage. Yes.
And what kind of skill gaps could emerge if public services become more automated?
It's a very good question, though. What we have so far and in the kind of education, universities, we are moving to that kind of the AI and especially educating next generation of, for example, in the context of our school, we're educating next generation of architects, planners, urban designers to work with AI and it's, you know, be ready for the market. But the main problem would be based on the people. They don't have this kind of opportunity, you know. So it's a kind of the thing. What AI is a range of the tools. It's not just one tool. So based on the works people are doing, they need to learn how this kind of technology can improve their productivity. And it's a kind of the institutions, government agencies, they need to provide this kind of opportunities for people to upskill themselves and be ready, you know, to use this emerging technologies. I name it disruptive technologies. AI is a disruptive technology. Disruption here has two sides, a positive, which means increasing, improving efficiency and increasing productivity. But also disruption has some cost. And people, in the different state, because when AI is one of the disruptive technologies, and it's a range of the disruptive technologies, people, based on the jobs they are doing, they need to have they should have a chance, you know, to learn about this, about the tools will affect their jobs, and adopt themselves, and be ready, actually, to through the process of the transition. Unfortunately, we don't have this kind of the services and support so far. I don't see that actually the level it should be to support the people that are in the in working place now, especially in the public sector. I think, it's a kind of, in universities we are moving to that direction, but for the ones, you know, that are in the workplace, maybe, you know, the government should work with the universities and other educational, you know, institutions to help them to upscale their workers based on the disciplines and the jobs they are doing. Because we have a range of the AI tools. They are doing different things. It's not just the ChatGPT. It's a range of the tools. And each discipline, each job, people should specifically learn about a particular AI related to their jobs. But I think most of the people are not fully aware about this. And they assume that it's just ChatGPT or a kind of the copilot or something like that. It's not just it. It's more profound and very diverse type of tools.
So is the concern around the government moving too quickly, or is the issue more about how AI is being introduced at all?
Both, actually. The thing is that it's a, we have, you know, the thing is that we knew that the technology is coming. At least from 2017, you know, I was teaching here in the university a smart city planning course, and we introduced this kind of technologies, you know, to the new generation of planners and architects and urban designers. We knew that it's coming, you know, and but we didn't have a plan for it. It's a problem. Still we have time, but it's a kind of the alarming. It's a first wave. You know, the thing is that the other waves will come. If we don't plan for it, if we are not ready for it, we'll face more consequences, socio-economic, emotional, well-being kind of consequences. So it's not a matter of it's too fast. It's like, do we have a plan for it or not? It's a kind of just an onset without any kind of preparation. Obviously, you know, it creates a kind of the tension and also a stress for people, and has associated costs. Most of the time, these kind of costs are not part of the calculations we have in our economic models, because most of the time we are using cost-benefit models, you know, in the kind of budgeting things. So we are looking for savings, but we are speaking about other type of the cost overlooked most of the time. It's a psychological, emotional stress associated with this one. So we need to help and have a plan ahead and gradually manage this kind of a transition to urban automation, urban digitalization, I name it, to mitigate that kind of the other costs for a human being that can adversely impact on the well-being of the people. It's a primary concern here. And I think the government somehow missed this point.
And just touching on the privacy and security risks that you were talking about earlier, what risks come with using AI in public services that sometimes deal with very vulnerable people?
Privacy is a huge thing, because most of the time this kind of, when we use AI tools, most of them are not developed in-house. They are kind of offered by international partners. You know, it's a, we know this, you know. So they are not necessarily following or, you know, kind of the Privacy Act and also the other kind of regulatory system we have in New Zealand to protect the peoples here. And so when we input the data there, we are actually somehow sharing that kind of the sensitive data with vulnerable people or, you know, individuals with a kind of external people. Any kind of communication we have through the kind of ChatGPT, Copilot or something, somehow we contribute that in the kind of the pool of the data. They have it overseas. So in that case, you know, it can create a kind of, and again, we don't know who will have access to it and how that will be used. So it's a lot of things about the privacy things. It can be used in different ways. It's not just the AI. It's a range of the things. For example, when we are speaking about the digitalization, a couple of months back, if you remember, our healthcare system, you know, was under attack, you know, and data stolen from the system. The other one, the good example, a couple of weeks back, we had the entire, you know, in the kind of the system we have in universities, Canvas pages, you know, shut down around the world. And Canvas is a kind of international platform. So all the data, all the information there was quite accessible for the hackers and the other ones. So it raises a lot of questions. When we encourage that kind of digitalization, we increase the vulnerability of our system, especially, you know, regarding privacy and privacy issues. Because, yeah, first of all, who have access to it and how they can use it is a big question. And also, hackers can hack their system, and because they are not based in New Zealand, it can raise a lot of issues. Another layer I think is very important for us. We should consider that. You know, we have a treaty, you know, and the Maori data sovereignty is very important here, and we need to consider that kind of layer as well. We have a very unique condition in this matter. So it's a lot of things, you know, government, local government agencies, all of them, they should consider if they want to go to that direction.
Do you think public servants are being properly included in conversations about AI and automation?
I think the thing is that it's one of the, I think, the roles of the government, because we are part of the open governance agreements, you know, New Zealand's part of it. And which means that, you know, if we have a kind of the things, government agencies and government sector and public sector should consult with the people, the level, and inform them, because it's create a kind of the matter of the trust. trust is the most important thing, you know, in the connection between the society and public sector. If they are using that and the kind of something like a privacy issue happens, somehow can damage the trust to the system, entire system. And rebuilding that kind of the trust between the communities and the government and the individuals would be so hard. So I think in that case, the government and government agencies, local governments should be careful what they are doing somehow. Yes, you can increase the efficiency and productivity, but we need to follow the steps and create a kind of framework to be sure what we are doing that will not damage the trust between the different groups, communities, and the government itself.
That was Dr. Mohsen Mohammadzadeh speaking about the risks of using AI to streamline public sector jobs and services.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to make a visit to Aotearoa, New Zealand later this year. The expected visit follows the signing of the trade agreement between India and New Zealand last month. However, Prime Minister Modi is a controversial figure in Indian politics, largely for his religiously divisive policy and anti-Muslim speeches. I spoke to Sapna Samant, GP, storyteller and activist, who was critical of Indian Prime Minister Modi and his supporters in the diaspora about his potential New Zealand trip. I started by asking about recent developments in the relationship between the New Zealand and Indian governments.
Indians have been in New Zealand since the 1700s. So we've always had a relationship with this Whenua. We have helped towards this building this nation. We have helped to create a vibrant economy, to contribute to the culture. We've always had a good relationship. But if you're talking with the people, you know, with New Zealanders and Tangata Whenua, we've also always had a relationship back with our people in India. So in 1942, there was a delegation of Gujarati men that went to India to support Mahatma Gandhi during the Quit India movement. Even before that, it was an Indian who discovered the first workable gold mine in Otago. So we've always had a good relationship with the people and this land. But if we're talking about governments, then there has been the current relationship that we're talking about between the Modi government and the Luxem government is purely based around neoliberalism and who can benefit economically rather than an exchange of ideas and relationships between Indians and New Zealanders. So when, you have governments walking up that this is great and we're going to have, you know, build the economies together, it's not really about the people. I have an issue when people talk about the free trade agreement as if it's some kind of magical agreement that's going to make everybody rich. Well, actually, it's just set within the neoliberal framework, benefiting only a few people. Not the common person, not the common Indian, and definitely not the common New Zealander. So this relationship talk is just superficial because we're not benefiting anybody except a few people.
I want to go back to asking about the purpose of a potential Modi visit to New Zealand. And I'm wondering if you could put this in a broader context of government visits or similar types of visits that have happened in the past.
I've lived in New Zealand since 2001, and I don't remember any Prime Minister of India coming over here. There have been ministers coming of different departments. Before 2014, it was the Congress government, and then after 2014, it has been the BJP government. So yes, those ministers have been coming. But specifically with regards to Modi, he just likes to travel around overseas. That's what he does, rather than governing and rather than being in India, working for and with the people of India. He just likes to just take off and visit different countries and then connect with the diaspora, Indian diaspora within those countries to show how popular he is. And this visit to New Zealand is no different. They're just using the free trade agreement as an excuse, but Modi basically just loves, that's his thing. That's how he keeps his popularity up amongst his followers and supporters, is to show how popular he is within the diaspora and how everybody just loves him. And it's a bit of a shame because since Iran has been invaded and there is a huge oil crisis across the world, Modi has told Indians not to travel, not to buy gold. There is a cooking gas problem happening in India. And here you have the Prime Minister of India using jet fuel to travel across the world. And New Zealand is about 17 hours away from India. So he is traveling such long distances without purpose, just to center himself. That's why he's over here. He is not here to advance anything for the people of India.
You've spoken to some of your criticism about the Modi government's economic policies, specifically relating to neoliberalism. But I also want to ask about something that you've been outspoken about and critical of, which is Modi's connections to the Hindu nationalists. Can you speak to this?
Yeah, so that is what exactly I was going to say regarding his visit over here, is this the event that they are proposing, or, you know, that Todd McClay also spoke about, a grand event in Auckland. This is a template that Modi has created for himself during his visits to every country overseas. These are essentially large gatherings of Hindu nationalists done under the pretext of a state visit. So under normal circumstances, one would be really concerned if white supremacists got together or if, say, Brian Tamaki's Destiny Church people got together, that there would be high security and people would be vigilant and keeping an eye on what's going on and what the corridor is about within that event. But here you have Modi under state patronage, who will still be given all the security that any prime minister or head of state gets, meeting up with Hindu nationalists, you know, extremists, fascists, who supposedly meeting and showing their power as an Indian community, but it's actually extremists who are talking about continuing with their Islamophobia and continuing with their oppression of minorities, with the anti-Maori racism over here. And this is exactly what this event is about. So my criticism continues, and my critique of the Indian community over here, who somehow feels this false pride that Modi is going to show the world about how, you know, Indians are on the rise. Well, actually, we should be looking for the fascists. We should be keeping our ears to the ground to know what the actual conversation is going to be about. It's going to be about how to advance Hindu nationalism in a small place like New Zealand.
That was Sapna Samant, who is a GP, storyteller and activist critical of Indian Prime Minister Modi on his expected visit to New Zealand later this year.
Classic journo question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. This is Marlon Williams.
Your friends when they stop calling,
too many times, but it's on them to get what they need from you. It's not on you to hold the line. That's how easy does it, and she does it every time. Easy does it, yeah, she does it every time. You are an expert in field of distance, but I bet that I know where you are. You're on some lonely, undiscovered island, my seldom South Pacific star, and that's how does it every time. Easy does it, yeah, she does it every time.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Crypto investment schemes are spreading across the Pacific, often through trusted family, church, and community networks. While they are promoted as offering financial freedom and fast returns, regulators have warned that some schemes carry serious risks and limited protections for investors. I spoke with Associate Dean Pacific Sione Tofa about how trust can be exploited in Pacific communities, why endorsement matters, and what people should know before investing. Now, to start broadly, what is happening with crypto investment schemes across the Pacific at the moment?
Yeah, we've seen a lot of crypto schemes come into the Pacific, and it's driven by what's happening in the US and overseas here in New Zealand as well. But it's starting to move into the Pacific, and it's a little bit concerning how they're targeting people, especially when some of these islands like Samoa, like Tonga, have actually come out, their reserve banks have come out and said, this is a scam, please do not interact with it. But we're seeing a lot more and more people not just falling for it, but also signing up for these schemes.
And why are these schemes becoming so visible in these Pacific communities?
I think it's because obviously, with crypto not quite regulated at the moment, and we can see it in some of the spaces in the US, here in New Zealand, we don't quite have the regulation for it, so it's more of a free-for-all. But in the Pacific, it's the allure of, you just give us a little bit of money, we can 10x that, or we can double that, or we can make it three times in a short space of time. And that get-rich sort of like idea is always something that the communities want to do, because when you have nothing and somebody offers you a better opportunity, people usually go for it.
Now, you said the issue is not simply technology but risk as well. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I teach accounting and finance at the business school, and we know that the higher the risk, the higher the reward. So, for example, you have things like Lotto, and the risk of the Lotto gives you a high reward if you win. But it's a higher risk whether you actually get it or not. You have a higher risk of losing your money. So when these crypto, so in a similar vein, when crypto promoters come to the Pacific and they talk about what you're going to get out of it after a period of time, or majority of people who don't quite get that risk only think about the reward. But when you think about something and it's probably too good to be true, it probably is. But we don't associate the risk with it. We just think, I give you my money, and in a couple of weeks or a month, I withdraw. There is no calculation of risk involved there anyway. And that's what we want our communities to take note of, that money is not free. There's always risk involved in some of these schemes, and even investment, and even some spaces like banks. So the risk of a bank is probably low, but then the reward from a savings or a term deposit is also low. So they've got to weigh that or take that into account when they make these decisions.
And you've mentioned that promoters associating themselves with respected public figures and community leaders or government officials, how can that affect the people's perception of the legitimacy of these schemes?
When you come from the Pacific, and especially here in New Zealand, because we might be big, but we're still a really big village, it's all about relationships. It's all about the people you trust. And it's the visibility that actually matters. And if they take a picture of you with, let's say, a pastor, or they take a picture of you with a minister or so, that visibility is usually taken as some sort of endorsement. And we can see it in Samoa at the moment because some of these promoters have taken pictures with government officials and government ministers. And government has come out, I think it was yesterday, to sort of like condemn that they know they are not promoting this, because people can take it the wrong way, because it's all about the relationships and the people you trust. And the more built in their trust, the more likely you are to invest or fall or go with some sort of scheme. Because if you think about our people, we only deal with people we trust, and they could be our uncle, or they could be the pastor, or they could be our family friend who we trust far more than any financial expert that you have no prior relationship with.
And how do you think that social pressure and those relationships play into influencing people into joining these schemes?
It does play a lot, especially when we look at some of these financial decisions. It's not taken as an individual, it's more about the collective as well. But I think the key thing here is the amount of education, or letting people know about risk and reward. Where do they make their money? Where does the scheme actually, or the financial growth comes from, or their business model revenue streams come from? Because if you're not quite sure how they're going to increase the wealth of your money, then it's probably a pyramid scheme or a Ponzi scheme and so forth. So it's not just, yes, trusting them, but trying to verify, but also have an idea that, yes, then I might get rich with this, but I also have a higher chance of losing my money or hard-earned cash if I go with this. So take into account that reward comes with risk. And I think once people understand the risk that is involved, they are much less likely to be taken for a ride with some of these schemes.
Is there a specific form that these crypto schemes take? Is there one structure that is definitely reoccurring within the space?
It's always flashy. The people show a platform, and it's usually just a platform of that particular promoter that shows, yeah, numbers going up or graphics and so forth. But it's not actually anything related to that, because they are not quite hooked up to, let's say, the financial markets and so forth. But I think the key idea is let them explain how they're going to increase their money. And if you feel like, is this good, too good to be true? It probably is. Ask yourselves, is this something, why is it that these people know that about these schemes and not a lot of people, well-known people around the community are buying into it? And I think the key idea is that listen to the regulators, whether it's the Financial Markets Authority, whether it's Reserve Bank, because they know about this stuff. heed to their advice, and just be careful. Just be careful, because we know because of poverty and because we want to help out, we want to increase our wealth. Everybody wants to do that, but that we don't fall into some of these schemes that might be worth a lot more trouble than they are.
Regulators, including New Zealand's Financial Markets Authority and Pacific Central Banks, have issued warnings about some of these schemes. Do you think these warnings are reaching the communities effectively?
Yes and no. At least, yes, in the sense that some of these countries are aware. No, in the sense that people still go for it, because they say, hey, I trust these people. And it's really hard sometimes to argue with a promoter when, let's say, the first people closer to the tip of the pyramid show up to those meetings with hard cash, and others, and the naysayers say, oh, it's a Ponzi scheme or it's a pyramid scheme, and then the first people who invest say, no, it's not, because here, look, at this is $5,000 cash in hand that I come with. And it's really hard to argue against that. So what people don't know is that they just happen to be the first in the queue, and if I join and if others join, eventually it's going to collapse, because they're going to either run out of people or run out of money. But yeah, it's always difficult when to argue against the perils of such promotions when people are coming in with cash in hand, but it's just that they're being paid first and not because it's a genuine scheme.
Finally, what is the main thing you want Pacific communities to understand about these schemes?
Understanding that there's risk. You don't just hand in money and expect to be paid in. And if you are going to hand in money, be prepared to take the risk that you might be losing that money as well. But don't just trust too easy. Ask a lot more questions. Crypto it's not about whether crypto is good or bad. The question is whether our people are entering these systems with genuine understanding. Do they have informed consent to give out their hard-earned cash, or whether they carry the most of the risk while others actually benefit. So we can't afford to build financial futures on hype while others carry the consequence. So maybe think about that in regards to the conversations we need to have with our communities.
That was Associate Dean Pacific Sione Tofa speaking on how crypto investment schemes are spreading through trusted Pacific community networks.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nese mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Dā Pare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, University of Auckland's Dr. Mohsin Mohamedzada, activist Sapna Samat, and University of Auckland's Sione Tofa. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.